Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
I'm Julia Tertian, host of Radio Cherry Bomb. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg, and my lovely co-host is out today with her family. So it's just me, and we have a really, really great guest. We're going to be talking today about myths in the backyard garden. Our host, C.L. Fornari, is an author and a plant geek and many other things. I'll get into her bio in a second, but we're going to be discussing her book called Coffee for Roses and 70 Other Misleading Myths About Backyard Gardening. Hello, CL. Are you on the line?
I am indeed.
Good. Welcome. So you're calling in from the Cape Cod, right? Cape Cod?
That's right. I'm calling from Poison Ivy Acres on Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
Tell me about that. I when I was reading your bio, I was very excited at the name.
Well, not only do I grow poison ivy quite well, but and you know, it's a plant. It has a lot to recommend it. It's a native plant, great fall color, berries for the birds.
Right.
If it weren't for that one little quality that it has, we would love that plant.
Yes.
But I guess that I call my acreage here Poison Ivy Acres because I think in both gardening and life, it's helpful to remember that it all contains both the flowering and the beautiful and the unwanted and itchy.
That's lovely. And that's actually one thing that was really striking about your book is all the comparisons you make and the kind of philosophical conclusions that gardens can give us. It's really lovely. It comes through really nicely in your book.
Well, thank you. I appreciate hearing that. I wanted to make the book as much fun and also as sort of memorable as some of these myths are themselves.
Right.
And I think one of the reasons myths are memorable is that they sometimes connect with something we already know about. So
So
I looked for ways to make the myths also, the truth about the myths or the debunking of the myths also connect with things that we already know about.
Exactly. So let me just tell our listeners a little bit about you. You are a gardener and an author. You've written 6 books, including Your Garden Shouldn't Make You Crazy, A Garden Wedding, and A Garden Lover's Martha's Vineyard. You've been a columnist for Angie's List magazine and Primetime magazine, and you've written several articles for American Nurserymen as well. And you host another radio program called Garden Line, which is a 2-hour call-in radio show on WXTK, and that's also streamed on 95WXTK.com. And before that, you were a weekly contributor to The Cultivated Gardener, which was heard on NPR stations, and you've been awarded the Garden Communicator Prize from the Perennial Plant Association, as well as you won a Award of Excellence from the Garden Writers Association in 2013 for your work online and on the radio.
Yes, indeed.
Good. So you also design gardens, and you garden yourself, and you have a great blog, right? Gardenlady.com?
Gardenlady.com is my website.
Is your website.
And I am currently blogging at coffeeforroses.com.
Okay. So when I first started reading the book, I think everybody has the question of how did you come to gardening? And your story seemed especially sweet, and it involved a wagon. Can you elaborate?
Well, when I was around nine, I lived in Muncie, Indiana. And a friend and I, my neighbor across the street, I think it was Babs Ward, she and I decided that we wanted something sweet, and we had no money. So how do you get money when you're a kid? You sell something. And so we stole some clay flower pots from behind the garage of the house my parents were renting at the time. We filled them with dirt. We put them in a radio flyer wagon, and then we dashed around the neighborhood picking flowers out of other people's gardens and crammed the stems of those picked flowers into the pots and then sold them door to door quickly before they wilted
right.
as potted plants.
I can picture it perfectly.
Well, the thing is, oftentimes we were selling them to the very same people who we had stolen the
right.
plants from in the
right.
first place.
Did anybody call you out that you remember?
No. I can only imagine we were cute because we actually did sell a few. Fortunately, as an adult in the plant biz, I've learned a lot about both ethics and the importance of root systems. So.
When you wrote that in your book, I giggled at that. So tell us the impetus for writing this book. We all hear about these old tips, and mm-hmm. what I found really interesting is you really just tackle every single one, and give us kind of the historical background and also the scientific background of why it works or why it doesn't.
Well, it's interesting because there were many that I had to leave out of the book. I often say that there are more myths about plants and gardening than there are about weight loss.
Right.
And there are lots about weight loss.
Yeah.
So, but the book came about because I wanted to write a different book. I approached St. Lynn's Press with an idea for a book about annuals, and they were initially interested in that. And I had an appointment with them to talk about doing that book about annuals. And in that conversation, the publisher, Paul, had been to my website, gardenlady.com. He saw that I talked about the most popular talk that I've given for at least 10 years now, called Myths, Lies, and All the Latest Dirt.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me to tell him a little bit about that talk. And after I did, he said to me, well, he said, the annual book idea is nice, but I'd really rather do a book about the myths.
Yeah.
So, and my response to him was, I'm happy to do a book about it, but only if I can make the book as much fun as the talk is. So
yeah.
That's how the book came about.
Good. Well, I think it's long overdue, your book, and I think it's really a nice, simple, quick read that's chocked with tons of information. And like you said, it is humorous, and I just love that you just every old story that your grandparents have told you over the years is talked about. And I also loved your analogy between a kindergarten teacher and a flower bed and the idea of personalities. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. Well, you know, sometimes people think that perennial gardens are the easiest, most low-maintenance garden.
Right.
Because perennials, theoretically anyway, come back every year.
Uh-huh.
And I adore perennials. I have several perennial gardens. However, they are not easy. They're the most high-maintenance garden you can plant.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason is that each perennial is different. Each perennial has its own personality. One is tried and true. The other one, if you get it back a second year, it's a gift from God.
Uh-huh.
One plant stays where you put it and performs beautifully in the same way year after year, like a peony, for example.
Uh-huh.
Another plant is an out-and-out thug that wants to take over the world.
Right.
And so it's like being a teacher in a classroom of 25 students where each student comes to that room with their own strengths and weaknesses and their own learning style and their abilities, and each one has a different home life and a different personality. And you as a teacher have to recognize what each student brings to the table and what help each of those kids needs.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to do all of that for each one of the kids in your class while keeping order in the classroom.
Right, right. And
getting
through the
curriculum.
And that's
what being a gardener is about, too, is you get to know each of those plants and what their personality is,
mm-hmm.
and you need to keep order in the garden.
Mm-hmm. We're starting our, garden cut-downs right now, and I was with the gardeners this morning at one of the sites, and he said, I really feel like this is the most cathartic time of the year. And I said, it is. You've seen the fruits of your labor, and now you get to rest. and you get to see what works and what doesn't, even in, the same plants in different gardens. And it's amazing how a rule of thumb is just a rule of thumb. It's not a dogmatic.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. I often say that, one of the things we learn from the garden is to never say never,
mm-hmm.
and to know that there are more than one route. There's more than one garden path through all of life, really.
Yeah.
And in the garden, it's true that we can talk about, generalities, that this should be done then and that should, be done in this way.
Yeah.
The bottom line is there are many ways to do it. There are many ways to grow perennials, just like there are many ways to skin a cat.
Exactly. Well, and the other thing that I love, though, is your book has an amazing list of perennials that require less maintenance, quote unquote, which I've actually found to be spot on. Because you do want less maintenance if you can get it. But again, that's not always, it depends on your site conditions and the rainfall that year. And, there are so many outstanding things. But I thought it was a fun list that you put together. So
good.
You did 70 misleading myths. Tell me about some that didn't make it into the book.
Oh, gee. Now, that's going to put me on the spot because, out of sight, out of mind,
right.
I just trashed them, I think. So some of them were actually regional. Some that didn't make it into the book were regional. I did find that in different parts of the country, there are different myths. And an example of that is that someone in Florida told me that there is a myth down there that a lawn benefits periodically by a top dressing of sand.
Oh.
And I'm talking pure sand.
Uh-huh.
So, so that's one that would be appropriate for a book about Florida garden myths, but in most of the rest of the country would not, for example. And there are various, there are innumerable home remedies that many of them didn't make it into the book either. So a few of them did, and I kind of generalized about a lot of them. But people are prone to be a little wacky when it comes to products that are under the kitchen sink.
I know.
And spreading them around the garden. And so there were many of those having to do with specific under the kitchen sink products that I didn't include, although I did include the myth that we can reach under the kitchen sink for a remedy for what's going on outdoors.
Right. But all right, let's start with the title of the book because you can't ignore it. Coffee for Roses. I was actually telling my mother about the interview with you over the weekend, and she said, "Well, Grandma Moore did coffee on her roses and eggshells, and her roses were beautiful." And I said, "Mom, do you really think that it was her little coffee grounds, really. That, like, and she really, well, she really thought
and
it.
You know, and it's funny because there is certainly nothing wrong with eggshells around roses or coffee around roses.
Right.
But if you're not a coffee drinker, you know, if you're a tea drinker, you could use tea leaves.
Right.
You could use corn husks.
Uh-huh.
You could use the ends of your green beans. You know.
Right.
You could use eggplant peels.
Uh huh.
The thing is, roses love organic matter.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we know that. We know that, you know, a top dressing of manure around roses is very good for roses.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's not that coffee is not good for roses. It's just that it doesn't have any magic rose woo-woo about it.
Yeah, 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 yeah. But it's so funny how common that, and like you said, It's only a breath, really, of an understanding of what the rose needs. You know, it's a tiny
right.
part of it, and but it's funny that that is so widely known. Like, these myths are so pervasive
mm-hmm.
in our gardening knowledge, which is actually kind of sad that people don't.
Well, there's sticky first of all in our brains because. First of all, as I mentioned, it connects gardening to something we already know. We already know about coffee. You know, we have many of us, caffeine addicts, have a daily interaction with coffee.
Right.
So that's one reason that it's sticky. It's also sticky because it's kind of fun.
Uh-huh.
You know, tossing your coffee grounds out around your roses, it combines two things we love, mm-hmm. coffee and roses. So there are many reasons that a lot of these myths are sticky. And they've been passed down across the backyard fence for many years. And, of course, now the backyard fence is the entire world on the Internet.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, yeah.
No wonder they continue to live.
So tell me, as I was reading the book, I was very interested, just because I love research, this must have been a really fun book to kind of identify the myths that you wanted to talk about and then to research them. I read at the kind of back of the book that you did a lot of work with the Library of Congress and a department called Chronicling America.
That's a website. And boy, anybody who's interested in U.S. history should know about this website
uh-huh.
because it's fantastic. You can go on Chronicling America and put in a search term and see for many states, small town newspapers that contain that search term. And not only do you see what newspapers contained that search term, you get an image of the newspaper, including the advertisements and all of the columns and everything, with the search term highlighted. And so as historical societies and libraries are digitizing old newspapers, they are put on this site by the Library of Congress, and it is so wonderful.
Yeah.
So you get a taste not only about what was going on in gardening at mm-hmm. that time in this small town, you know, maybe in Topeka, Kansas, or, you know, somewhere in Arizona or Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
But you also can see the advertisements that ran on that page and who had a tea for whom and who was pouring and,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah,
and
okay.
So it... The only thing about it is you can get lost for hours, you know, because
yeah.
it is fascinating and it is just wonderful to be able to research various, you know, whether it's something political or something to do with gardens.
Uh-huh.
And so that was one way that I could see, well, when did some of these myths first appear?
Uh-huh.
And then looking through Google Books, it was another way that I could do it, because if I went to the Google Books search engine and put in a term, I could see when that term started appearing in books.
Right.
Or other printed materials. That was one way that I discovered that the myth about peonies and ants, mm-hmm. and ants helping peony buds to open,
yeah.
was not being kept alive in gardening books. Gardeners for years have poo-pooed that whole idea. it was being kept alive in sermons and inspirational guides and uses as a metaphor for having to put up with the creepy and the crawly in order to get to something beautiful, you know.
Oh,
but that's where the
really
myth was kept alive.
That's really interesting. Well, that's what I was going to ask you. So when you were doing your searches, was that kind of how you were able to select the myths that you did choose in the book by like the like surveying the number of articles that you found?
Well, not so much. The way that I picked the most common myths, and once I got up to about 65, then, you know, as most writing a book is sort of like planting a garden. You start out with an ideal in mind, and then you make compromises.
Uh-huh.
And so I started out with 65 myths, and then the publisher, having the practicalities of printing in mind, said to me, well, we either need 70 or we need, you know, the
right.
next number, right?
Right.
And
right.
And so, well, then I honed in on the number 70 as what we would do.
Yeah.
So, and many of the myths, as I mentioned, I've been speaking about, so I knew those had to be included. I knew that certain myths that everybody has heard and done,
right.
like putting rocks in the bottom of pots for drainage.
I know.
We've all done that.
I still do it. And it was
so
fascinating to read.
Those had to be in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we have to take a break, CL. Hang on. And then when we come back, let's talk about some of the myths and let's debunk them with all of your knowledge. Hang on. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network.
You are listening to Aztec Soldiers by Spiral Jetty Club.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
That was so sweet. those kids are so sweet. Anyway, we're back now with C.L. Fornari and her book, Coffee for Roses. So, C.L., let's start talking about some of these myths. And let's start with the tomato plant, because I think everybody has grown a tomato plant. And let's talk about the idea of suckers on a tomato plant.
The idea, suckers, I know.
Yeah.
Why are they called suckers?
Right.
You know, they're not sucking anything.
No, I feel like a sucker for knowing this.
But for some reason, that's what people, you know, began to call those little shoots that come out in between a branch and the main stem on a tomato.
Mm-hmm.
And on indeterminate varieties of tomatoes, those little shoots actually grow into another branch, which photosynthesizes and creates energy for the plant, and also flowers and bears fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it is true that if you take off those so-called suckers, you will get slightly earlier tomatoes, maybe, weather depending. And you might get slightly larger tomatoes, variety depending. But with an indeterminate variety, if you leave them on, you'll get more tomatoes.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, but I don't want bigger or a week earlier. I want more.
Yeah, exactly. Another myth that maybe you can shed some light on is deadhead the flowers off of the tomatoes, which I find silly because that's where the tomato comes from. So why would you take the flower off?
Yeah, I'm not sure why anyone would do that, other than I think some of these myths start out actually from a very sweet part of ourselves. We want to help.
Yeah.
And, you know, we want to help. We want to make it better.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, sometimes we help going downhill, as the old Italian expression says.
Yeah.
So,
or we stir the cake too much.
That's an example of helping downhill.
Yeah.
It does not, you know, help the plant at all. Then, and our tomatoes will or should have tomatoes perfectly well on their own if we leave the flowers alone.
Right.
And let them blow in the wind and all of the other things that help with tomato fertilization.
Right. Another thing that I loved is you have this very simple, like let nature do kind of philosophy, which I really liked. In that it doesn't need all this helping, this extra human work that we do. You know, like for instance, number 18 in your book, myth number 18 is the soil in vegetable gardens needs to be turned every year. Now, I think everybody probably believes that, and they work very hard to do that. But as you say, in the forest, things are not turned every year, and forests are lovely.
That's right. Well, Mother Nature doesn't own a rototiller.
Right.
So, but there are, you know, there are some advantages to turning soil.
Right.
And there are kind of two schools of thought about growing vegetables in either unturned soil or turned soil, and there are advantages both ways. And so it's up to every gardener to find what works best for him or her, or to use something in between. You know, I remember visiting the Rodale Experimental Farms down in, I believe it was North Carolina one time, and they will, in a farm field, this wasn't a home garden, these were farm fields, they would plant without turning the soil for 3 years in a row, and then the next year turn that soil. And the reason that they did it about every third year is because it, by the end of that third year of not turning, the weeds had gotten out of hand in the farm field. And so then they would turn and start out fresh and not turn again for 3 years.
Uh-huh.
And so they were experimenting with, you know, not all the way in one direction and not all the way in the other. And that, I think, has a lot of merit, you know, that we don't necessarily think that it has to be done this way. So there are many people like Lee Reich, who wrote the book Weedless Gardening. He does not turn his soil.
Yeah.
And one reason that he does not turn the soil is because it exposes weed seeds to the light.
Right.
And so he doesn't want to have more weeds.
Right.
So we do turn our soil most times because that's just sort of the way that we've gotten, you know, involved in gardening. And here where we have very sandy soils, we turn in organic matter on a yearly basis. So.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that that whole topic in your book about soils and fertilizers. And let's talk about clay and the idea of mixing sand into the clay, because that was really fascinating to me.
It is interesting because it has a certain amount of sense, doesn't it?
You
have very heavy clay that retains too much water, and on the other hand, sand doesn't retain anything, nutrients or water.
Right.
And so doesn't it make sense if you mix the two together that you would get a lighter soil?
Right.
The actuality, however, is that you get something that very closely resembles cement.
Uh-huh.
And there are several reasons for that, including disrupting the soil structure and having to do with the composition of both sand and clay. But again, if we look out to nature, for what Mother Nature does with improving clay soils. What does nature do? The leaves drop on the top of clay soils, and the earthworms drag them down, and the beetles chomp on them, and the little pill bugs and the earwigs and all of those insects that eat decaying plant matter work on them. And though that organic matter then lightens soil from the top down. And so that's, you know, that is the ideal way to lighten soil. Clay soil is with organic matter from the top down.
Right.
And the interesting thing is it's also the way that you improve sandy soils. Organic matter from the top down.
Yeah, it's funny that it's the same treatment. And I additionally, I love your plant list again of plants that can tolerate clay soil. I thought that was just brilliant. And and your photo of the Lespedeasia that grows perfectly well in your garden because it was on a slope, even though it's planted in heavy clay soil.
Yes. Well, I grew in pure clay. Well, it was a sort of a combination of rock and clay when I lived in New York's Mid-Hudson Valley. So I became a clay expert when I was out there. And then I moved to the opposite extreme on Cape Cod, where you dig down a few inches and you hit a beach.
So
I have experience with both types of soil. I'm not sure that I've ever gardened for any length of time where there was really wonderful loam.
Well, I mean, that's that's a gardener's dream, you know, but I think we all work towards that. That's right.
Well, and I sometimes say to people, if you have really wonderful deep loam, just shut up about it.
Exactly.
The rest of us don't want to know.
Exactly. As we're like repairing our shovels and our, you know, from hitting
that's
rock.
That's right. And hauling our composted manure. And all of our leaves and pine needles and all those other wonderful soil amendments.
And that's what we should be using the Epsom salt for, is our sore back, not our gardens.
That's right. The bath. That was one of the fun things that I found through the Chronicling America site. It's when I searched on Epsom salts, I came up with so many uses for Epsom salts, from stiffening curtains to curling hair to facial hair removal. And as I say in the book, when a product is recommended for both curling hair and removing hair, it kind of gives you pause.
Well, it's the same. I'm sure you've seen those videos of what Coca-Cola does to your, you know, porcelain, and if you have stains on your porcelain, clean it with Coke, and then here we are like drinking it at the same time. It's very strange. So let's go back to another myth that I loved, was the, because I myself kind of struggle with this, two plants, the clematis. Was a great, but first let's talk about how to prune roses. Everybody has this issue of when to deadhead and how to prune. And let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, I was told as a young gardener that you should deadhead your roses because if you take off the developing seeds, they're more likely to bloom again.
Right.
And that's true for many types of roses. Some roses, no matter what you do, will not bloom a second time in the year or continue flowering. But for many roses, that's true about deadheading. But what I was told was that you had to make the cut above a set of five leaflets. So I have been 4 years out in the garden going, one, two, three, four, five. That's where I can cut. It was reducing my garden maintenance to an episode of Sesame Street. You know, today in the garden is brought to you by the number five. So I was astonished when I started talking with rosarians about this, and so many of them poo-pooed that myth. I mean, these were really top rosarians.
Right.
So then I absolutely loved it when their view was confirmed. I read maybe about 10 years ago about a study that they'd done in Europe where they had rosarians and rose gardens all across Great Britain, deadhead when they had two varieties that were the same or more, half of the plants in that old above a set of five leaflets way, and the other half by taking hedge trimmers and chop, chop, chop off with their heads.
Right.
And what they found was that the plants that had been deadheaded by the chop, chop, chop off with their heads rebloomed just as well, or sometimes even better.
Even better, right.
Than the ones that had been meticulously counted down to the set of five leaflets.
Yeah.
And I thought, hallelujah, this speeds up our, you know, deadheading tremendously.
Yeah. And, you know, that's funny because I actually am a bit of a lazy gardener, and I would get really irritated at the counting. So I would just cut. I was just like, I'm just going to cut. And, you know, roses in old cemeteries, they're always blooming. They're gorgeous. Stephen Scaniello, the great, rosarian, I heard him speak once on when he looks for old roses, he just goes to the cemetery because that's where the best roses are, you know. Mm. And I thought, you know what? That's going to be my rule of thumb. And I was lazy and I didn't want to count. So I just started cutting, and I've never had a problem with roses not blooming, unless it's one that only blooms at certain times, you know. It depends on the variety, but and then the clematis. I was just this morning speaking with our gardener about the clematis, and he said, "Should I cut this clematis?" And I said, "You know what? Don't touch it. Let's wait, because I can never remember which one to cut and which one not to cut. There's so many crazy varieties that I just wait until the spring and I see what's dead and what's alive, and I prune it out."
Yeah, well, and you know, sometimes we make things as gardeners and garden communicators, we make things far more complicated than they need to be. And you'll hear people talking about, well, is your clematis a type A, a type B, or a type C? You know, when one blooms on new wood and one on old wood and one on both new and old.
Yeah.
And nobody knows what type they have.
Exactly.
And so, you know, you just can't go wrong by pruning a clematis right after it flowers.
Yeah.
No matter what variety you have, prune it right after it flowers. Done.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yep. So, and then the other funny thing I laughed about with clematis was the old adage of feet in the wet and head in the sun.
Heads in the sun and feet in the shade.
Yeah, right.
And I've even gone into some public gardens where they've built special little screens for the clematis roots. And the thing is that, again, the experts know that this is not so. Clematis growers grow these plants in black plastic pots on black asphalt or black landscape fabric in the full sun.
Yeah.
What clematis experts know is that the plants aren't particularly drought tolerant. That's where this myth came from. And so I can imagine in days before irrigation or whatever, if a clematis, people probably noticed that if a clematis was growing, you know, and the base of it was shaded, it did better, and that was just because in shade, the water doesn't evaporate from the soil as quickly.
Yeah, right.
So that's all it is. You can grow clematis out on your lamppost in the middle of the lawn in the full sun, and you don't have to shade the base. You just need to water it deeply once a week, that's all.
Or build a very elaborate teepee.
That's right.
So a couple more that I found really interesting is let's revisit the debris that we all seem to put in the bottom of our pots for drainage.
That's
mentioned it a little earlier.
That's probably the one that astonishes people the most.
Yeah.
And my aha moment on this, because for years I put rocks and shards in the bottom of my pots. And my aha moment came when I had a plant, a house plant, that was not doing well. And so I decided, well, maybe it needs a new pot. And I took it out of its pot, and I noticed that all of the feeder roots from that plant had gone down into the bottom of the plant, where they were down there among the rocks, not in soil.
Right.
And so here all these roots were down where there was no nutrition, there was no water, there was nothing there for them.
Right.
And that started me thinking, well, wait a minute, why do we do this? And then I realized that I had never purchased a plant from a commercial grower that had a rock or a shard in the bottom of that pot.
Right.
Because the commercial growers know that it's bad for plants. It is bad for plants.
Right.
And when it comes to drainage, that's what the hole in the bottom of the pot is for.
Right.
And you will never buy a plant from a commercial grower who, you know, plants are their business. You will never buy a plant that has rocks or shards or a coffee filter covering the hole or a piece of screening over the hole.
Yeah.
Commercial growers know that the soil does not come out of the holes.
Right.
And that anything but soil, potting mix, in that pot is bad for the plants.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, and I've done it for my clients. I do it for myself. But you're absolutely right. And I'm a plant person, and I never put two and two together. And it was very enlightening to read that. And you're absolutely right. A grower would never do that. Right.
Roots in a container go to the bottom of the pot.
Exactly.
Period.
Exactly. Now, one other, this book is so full of fun myths, so I'm encouraging people to read it. Let's not talk about all of them. But let's end on the one that Carmen and I get asked a lot about in our gardening business, because everybody wants moss in their garden, right? They just love the idea of moss. And Martha Stewart says, mix it with some yogurt in a blender and you will spread it on in the cracks, you know, between your stones.
Yeah, even Martha has succumbed to that blender thing.
Yeah.
You know, the problem with mixing moss in a blender, yes, moss has the ability to regenerate from a small piece.
Right.
The problem with the blender or the food processor and moss is that it pulverizes the moss into such small pieces that they're going to instantly dry up unless you have a mister 24 hours a day on that area.
Right.
They're going to dry up.
Right.
And so it really doesn't make any sense. And, you know, where the yogurt, or some people say beer, comes from, you know, Mother Nature, when she grows moss, she does not run to the dairy case.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure that Mother Nature has better things to do with beer than,
exactly,
you know, to pour it out on the moss. So moss loves moisture, compact soil, right?
Uh-huh.
Fairly low fertility and lack of competition. That's the other thing.
Right.
In the moss gardens that the Japanese grow so beautifully, they don't do that with yogurt or blenders. They grow moss beautifully because they remove the competition.
Yeah.
They weed out, you know, whatever plants are trying to take over in that area so the moss can thrive.
Right, right.
And if we want to grow moss well, we just need to put some small pieces, not pulverized in a blender, but stick some small pieces in between those cracks, and then water it frequently.
Exactly. And walk away and let nature do its thing and keep it out of the direct sunlight.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Moss likes frequent moisture, shade, and compact soil. You give it any one of those, and you can grow moss.
One final thing about your book that I really liked and appreciated were the Did You Know sections. And I really found that amazing tidbits of information. It was very entertaining to read, and your book is so highly recommended. I just found it perfect. So thank you.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And I just want to finish with the title, Coffee for Roses. We started off calling this Garden Myths. And when the publisher took the book to his sales force, the sales force said, Garden Myths is a boring title.
Yeah.
Come up with something else. And so that's how it became Coffee for Roses.
Yeah, well, it's what you think it's going to be, because I think it's a great title, because, like, you know, everybody stumbles upon that myth at some point, and nobody really knows whether it's true or false. Well, if you would plug your radio show again and your website and your blog one more time for our listeners.
Sure. Well, my website is gardenlady.com, and on that website is a link to my blog, Coffee for Roses, as well as a link to Garden Line Radio, which I host Saturday mornings from 8 a.m. till 10 a.m. It's a call-in show. And so everything can be found at gardenlady.com.
Good, good. Well, thank you for joining us, CL. It's been a pleasure. And I'm sure you're having some beautiful weather up there on the Cape, right?
I was outside today cutting down frost-tinged annuals and counting my blessings that it was in the upper 50s, because it's November and it's not going to last much longer.
I know. We've had an amazing fall, a long, beautiful Indian summer.
Absolutely.
So, well, thanks for joining us. And we will post on our Facebook fan page and on our Twitter account kind of a recap of the show and of your blog and all of that. And just wanted to say thanks for having us again or for being with us again. And look forward to a nice short winter, I should say.
That's right. Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure, and wishing everyone a mild winter.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Thanks for joining us today on We Dig Plants, Heritage Radio Network. We'll be posting pictures on our Facebook fan page of some of the myths, and asking you if they're true or false. So grab the book. And happy gardening. Join our Facebook fan page for free giveaways. Thanks for listening.
Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit organization broadcasting over 30 live shows a week. To learn more and donate, visit our website or connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.